say getting up to work is different from, are you still making work, and kind of where those things might actually sit side by side, working on and making artwork. So I'll hand over to Daniel Kelly from DKUK London for a chat, informal chat.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and thanks for coming, everybody. It sounds like it should be very in keeping the themes with what I want to discuss. So DKUK is an art gallery and a hair salon, and also it's neither of these things. It's a place that exists to make the discussions around art more commonplace. We support artists by training them as hairdressers and commissioning exhibitions. Our clients get their hair cut while receiving art. That's our mission statement. I've been doing a bit of work on that this year. So DKUK is simply DKUK. We're in the business of providing experiences. At the beginning, I thought about it as this. It was split into two fractions, the art gallery and the hair salon. And that was kind of my life. But as it's grown and as people have joined, I've had to bring it all together, and it's just become its own thing. And the hairdressing staff who've joined find some things weird, and art staff who joined find other things weird. But for my own sanity, I had to just pull it all together. So an example that highlights this quite well is, as a hairdresser, you can't be late for work. You know, your client's in at 10 o'clock, and you need to be refreshed and dressed and ready to start before they come. And in the art world, it seems that it's totally fine to start work at 10 past 10 and work 10 minutes later. But the hairdressing staff are fined for coming in late, because it's like, you really can't do that. So there was, it got to this point where I just had to level everything off and sort of say, no, if you're the art staff, we're having the meetings, let's do start bang on time. And so it's become much easier to sort of grow the business since I've sort of pulled it all together. So every element of what we do has equal consideration, whether that be the shade of green in the upcoming Richard Woods show that we're discussing at the moment, or the hand soap to set the right tone in the new shop, which can be a little bit of a treat, but something unexpected without being too try hard or overly expensive. So we've been open for 4 years, and we've been working with Arts Council England for 3 of those years. And they love the mix of art and business. We use the profits from the hair salon to support the exhibition programme. Currently 70% of our audience don't usually visit galleries. Recently one client said to me, this is probably the longest I will ever look at an artwork. And that had never occurred to me, that would be an experience that I'm offering somebody. And I think that's quite profound in a way. Even I did these podcast interviews with every artist that we exhibit, and sit them in front of their work and record it with binaural microphones and interview them while cutting their hair. So because it's binaural microphones, you can kind of hear the scissors and me moving around them. And even Z, who's the current painter, said it was a completely different way to look at the painting. She'd made the thing, sitting so close to it for an hour. And you can't really move your head either, but it's a very captive audience. We've done about 48 exhibitions. So the talks now, I can't really go through every exhibition and describe what I've done, but I wanted to use this as a chance to crystallise my thoughts, what I've been thinking about over the last year, as I've been becoming much more of a sort of treating it much more like a business. What I want to talk about is the cost of creative expression. So who's paying for what? The talk is not academically rigorous in any way, but it's just some thoughts. So please don't give me too much of a hard time. But it's sort of bits from all over the place, and it's been really fun to make, because I haven't made a sort of slide talk or had the distance or time to step back from what, take a minute and step back, have a think about what I'm actually doing. So thank you again. So this was Claire Price's exhibition. She did these two really big paintings, and she actually painted some hair. She'd never done any hair dyeing before, but she actually L'Oreal had released this new crazy colour type hair dye, and it was very close to the palette that she used. So she did this kind of private performance where she came in and got some models and sort of painted on their hair, and it was really interesting. She'd approached it in a way that a hairdresser never would. But you can see the proximity. That last slide as well, that's kind of half the space that we've got, really. It's 6 meters by 2 meters. So I can actually touch both walls. I've just picked up the keys, partly why I'm a bit tired today, is I just picked up the keys yesterday for a new shop. So I'm going to tell you about that a bit later. So that's very exciting. So I've been reading a lot about business, how to run a business and how to be a business person, because I never really wanted to be a business person or an entrepreneur or a boss. Definitely didn't want to be a boss, and I've never really had any responsibility before either, so it's been quite a tough few years. But you just end up starting doing these things as an artist, and then you kind of look back and think, how did I get this far in now? I better carry on. So one of the best business books I read was by it was the guy who started Pixar, and I've been thinking about how I don't know if you found the same when you start a gallery, you're just kind of doing it because you absolutely love it, but actually to try and think about it as a business and how to survive, and when people have got jobs and pensions and all this other stuff, it's a really tough place to be. So I've been thinking about businesses that combine creativity and successful business. And in the art world, if you're not going to be selling a lot of stuff, then it's quite tricky. But Pixar do it really well. So they combine the creative expression and business, yeah. So they've won 50 Academy Awards out of 14 films. And grossed over $600 million average for each film. And the reason they're really different in the film industry is because they applied like a crit type scenario to the development of their films. And I mean, that doesn't sound too radical for us, but in the film industry, that is, from what I gather, that's a big difference. I think when there's so much money invested in a creative idea, I think at Disney and other big studios, you'd do a screening and then you'd get given notes by the boss, the directors, and they weren't suggestions, they were like what you had to change, and you'd really have to sort of do what they say. Whereas at Pixar, the artist or the director is the sort of person charged with these films, making the film. And they present, it's really nice when you start at Pixar, no matter what your job is, a cleaner or coffee shop operative, they say you're a filmmaker. No matter what you did before today, you're a filmmaker now. Mm. And that's really nice. So they do these dailies, they call them, where every day they show like the yesterday's animation, like a couple of seconds or whatever they've been working on, and everybody can sort of chip in and say what they think. And then in a bit more in depth, they call them brain trusts. And that's where they'll show the whole film, and the guy who wrote the book, whose name I didn't make a note of, said that all their films start off terrible, and they're sort of born into life, and they have to sort of. He specifically said we don't carve them away because they're not already there, but we have to sort of grow them and feed them and grow these things. So they really empower the director to make the decisions. So they'll show the film and then they'll feedback, and they might say what's working or what's not, and the company will all like chip in. But nobody says what they do, what they have to do. It's all down to them to find their own way. I wasn't really a huge fan of Pixar before I read the book, but I have been back and watched a few of their films, and they are fun. But yeah, I really admire this sort of space of what they give to their filmmakers. And of course there's a balance between the marketing department and the finances and the artists there and the technology, but it seems like they're sort of doing that really well. And they're in this amazing position of, they do shelve films sometimes, but they might have, and they've got it down for animation where it'll be a small team working on it, but still that could be like a small team of four or five working full time for a year to develop an idea. Think about that compared to art, and like how much you get paid to do an exhibition. As we're moving into a bigger space, I've sort of taken a step back, rather than just following a formula for Arts Council, is kind of actually really thinking about how I want to make exhibitions. And what was really nice in what I was doing at the beginning was it was just me and an artist, not really a friend, because I did shows with friends quite early on. By the time we'd got the money, I wasn't showing friends' work, but artists who I'd have quite a long relationship with, and we'd chat, and maybe over a year or so they'd come and get a haircut and really get a feel for what it was like to be in this space. And it's a unique, like I alluded to earlier, it's a unique environment for showing art in. You've got a captive audience who are there for an hour, sometimes three if they're having colour, and then I would be there cutting hair. You'd develop the show, being a sort of like a presenter or a guide for the exhibitions, and I want to sort of scale this up now, and I'm thinking, well, how can we keep that same involvement in making the shows and that same openness? If we've got a team of sort of 5-10 hairdressers, artists that we've trained, so they're comfortable with it, but they need to feel like they've had a sort of stake in this exhibition, because they are kind of part of it, and they're certainly the visitors' guides to it. So I thought a good way to do that would be develop the show over a long period of time, get the artists in, do a bit of a sort of, not a crit, but they would do a presentation to the whole staff and get a chance to ask about the sort of layout of the salon and how it works with visitors. Can we start the video when they come and sit down? Do people normally ask questions or whatever it might be? But of course that's going to take a lot of money, and I don't know if you can get enough money off the Arts Council to program shows like that. You get a couple of £1,000 maybe from the Arts Council to make an exhibition. So I've really been thinking, yeah, how I can make that in, and kind of this whole talk has helped me justify that. Basically, when we move spaces, I'm going to have to charge a lot of money for the haircuts. But I did a talk with some like a podcast recording a few weeks ago with some other artists from spaces in London, and probably the biggest question that came up is, should people be paying for the pleasure of coming to see art? And I'm starting to think that they should, but maybe we can talk about that in a bit. So yeah, this was a show by Jack Strange, and this was really nice, one of my favourites. And so this is Dancing Hare. See here, there's a little hole. There was one hare there, which was sellotaped with a fan. And the fan was sort of blowing, so the hare is dancing. And then he's got this disco music playing. And then it's filmed here. And then sort of beamed round to a monitor here. And there's like a close cropped image with a light on, just of the hair sort of dancing to the music. So yeah, Jack Strange, he was great. And there's me sort of holding court, chatting. And then this was Alan Kane. And this is the first tombstone furniture that he's made. It's called Vanity Sweet Story. And we're in quite a small arcade, and these both got a lot of looks. We also toured this one to Leeds as well, in the shopping centre when the British Art Show was there, because he'd made some ventures out of tombstones. I think up to this point we showed a lot of video, and this was quite intense. You do kind of ask yourself, what am I putting people through? It's a bit cold as well to sit on the stone while you're getting your hair cut. But yeah, at the beginning it was just like this white space just with the exhibitions, and so it's very much almost like an art fair booth, really. And the hairdryer was the only thing that was sort of part of the permanent display. But as time's gone on, as you saw from the picture earlier now, I wasn't really happy with that. I wanted it for people to walk past and, rather than just say, oh, what's that? That's a bit weird. Say, oh, that's a hair salon with art in it. And Claire's show was the first one where we achieved that. So I've sort of brought the whole model in closer to... I just like to think I've given equal balance now to the hairdressing and the art. And you get a lot of cafes that call themselves galleries because they've got art as decoration. But yes, yeah, the push and pull between the two things. So yeah, I think this idea of freedom as an artist, I suppose that's what we're that's why we have less money than the directors making Toy Story 3, because you've got more freedom. So this is Free's Art Fair, but then as a commercial gallery, I mean, you've definitely got limits on what you can show there. And the art fair model is putting huge pressures on small and mid-sized galleries. There's been lots of them closing down in London. Vilma Gold and Laura Bartlett, to name a few. So I suppose it's the more freedom you have, the less money you have. But then that's not very fair, because it's the artists then who are subsidising this creative expression. So I don't know what the answer is to that. And I suppose that's partly geared up to like how the economy works now. It seems like there's a lot of people thinking about, finally, different economic models. There's a book called Donut Economics, which I heard about on the Ed Miliband podcast. Does anyone listen to that? Reasons to be Cheerful, that's really nice. Yeah, so it's like fascinating insight into politics from someone who just doesn't give a shit anymore. But they're also like looking at, you know, the cooperative movement, or there'll be a different sort of model each week, and they're sort of going into detail, or universal basic income, and they're really getting to grips with the idea. So yeah, donut economics, so that was a really nice rethinking of an economic model where you've got I can't remember now, the environment in the middle of the ring and all the limitations here that you're pulling from, recognising that they're limited, and then you've got an outer ring which is everyone who's got to, you've got to look after. And then in between, we've just got to operate between those two areas within the economy. So we've got limited natural resources, we've got people we need to look after. What can we do to sort of sort everyone out within that the parameters of those things? So this is my sort of fly-by-night sort of art history lecture in three slides. So this is the Lion Man, and was made around 40,000 years ago, and the British Museum suggests it took more than 400 hours to make. It's 31 centimetres tall, and tests suggest it was passed around for a group of people to be rubbed. So I guess it's like one of the oldest examples of artwork where the artist would have been supported by their community to make this. They would have been sort of out hunting so that someone could spend the time to make this ritual, make this object, which was part of the ritual, which I guess was seen as really important. So that's really nice that the community was supporting the artists to make their thing. And then I guess at the other end of the scale, there's the Renaissance model where I was hoping I was going to be able to put this into a really groovy diagram, but it never happened. So you've got there with the cavemen artists supported by society. The Renaissance art was clearly at the service of the church, and there was no problem. It was a profession and a job that you got into and trained, and you had your patrons, and you learned your craft and charmed the patrons and painted two-point perspective and got away with what you can. And then with the did anyone do art history? My impression of the Impressionists is that they were kind of like, that's where our, tell me if I'm wrong, but that's where our idea of the artist as a sort of like lone artist comes from, and that they were perhaps struggling to represent the world in a different way, and probably privately wealthy or very poor. But I mean, if you think of Van Gogh, he had his brother who was sort of supporting off him. So the Arts Council was set up following the Second World War in the 40s to support the opera. It was mainly the haunt of the aristocracy up until roughly 1968, when the community arts movement appeared. It had a focus on site-specific, interactive, political art. So this is a slide taken from the Blackie Community Centre Come Art Gallery. It was showing high art alongside local artists' works. It's still in operation today in this enormous church in Liverpool. And so my understanding was that in those times, you had taken money from the Arts Council, that was seen as your sort of, I suppose that's sort of state-sponsored art, in a similar vein as the sort of cave paintings. And from what I gather, if you were sort of taking money from private sources then, that was seen as a bit of a sellout. You sort of, the more pure sort of political or non-commercial art, was seen as something a bit purer, maybe. And in 2012, Arts Council launched a Catalyst programme, which was a fund to help organisations diversify their funding streams and bring in money from the private sector. So this, I think marked a big change. And this is why you see patrons' names on the walls in most galleries and additions for sale. So I think there's quite a lot of pressure now on Arts Council funded spaces to be getting money from other sources. And from chatting to other gallery owners, they're struggling with this. Because there's only so much money from philanthropy to go around. We don't have a sort of, not like America, we don't have a big culture of giving. And so this is why DK UK is doing really well, and I think we come up quite a bit internally in the Arts Council as a sort of example of someone who's making this work. We get people walking past and they're sort of, oh, there's an art gallery sponsored by the Arts Council, that's really good. And so I think that's quite important part of what we're doing, is keeping this discussion around. And I don't know what I think about it. I mean, obviously it's great for us to be able to put on these shows, but it's very complicated. Someone's got to pay for the exhibitions in some way. Is this place funded purely by the Arts Council?
No, we're a mix. We intend to be, I think, in Wales, apart from some very big, I say, key organisations, but below a certain level, we're a mix of 45% Arts Council, and some other funds and sources and voluntary on top of that. So it's a slightly different, but not so similar.
And the voluntary, is that from the sort of community?
Or from staff that here and people, like, we wouldn't have survived as long as we have for that.
Oh, people volunteering. This is my latest audio book that I'm reading, or listening to rather, A New Power by Jeremy Hymans and Henry Tins. And it's basically talking about old power, which is top down, slow, reliable, and predictable state. And new power, which is more like the Ice Bucket Challenge, which is crowdsourced and decentralized. Old power will obviously always have its place. You wouldn't want your root canal surgery done by someone who has learned from a YouTube video. But if you're struggling to get a diagnosis, a crowdsourced website like CrowdMed might be useful. What's the art of the new power world? I think art's been really slow to adapt. And that's basically because in London you get a real sense of the commercial art world. And that's about 30 people who are keeping everybody else, who buy art, who are sort of keeping everyone else in work. You know, the art handlers and the shippers and all this. And all my friends, basically. So it's not really in their interest for, like, the rest of us are all sort of underneath in this massive pile, all like pretending we're kind of part of this like glamorous art world by jetting off to Venice on EasyJet. And I don't know, it's kind of time to rethink that a little bit, and I think the responsibility is on all of us to kind of rethink how, like, art, the ideas that are transmitted through art can be disseminated. You don't see a lot on Instagram or online with this new, like, art in the new power world. So HBO started because in America, the advertisers, they've got no BBC, so the advertisers, I didn't know this until researching this talk, but the advertisers had so much sway on the TV programmes that they limited the sort of creative voice. So HBO came about, pay-per-view, to give the directors more freedom. And that worked, I guess, in such a big country where you only need sort of a small percentage and you get enough money to make something good. And now, obviously, Netflix is the biggest producer of TV in the world, which is a member service. So with my model, I'm thinking I can, like, just charge loads of money for the haircuts and then still keep it open. We do pay what you can for your first haircut. It was a way to sort of, it was partly as a way to just get anyone in at the beginning, but also keep it really open. So I think everyone should have the chance to experience art in the way that I present it. And so I would still keep that offer on, and I'd have the new trainees still at a cheaper price, but it would be a tiered pricing system, so to eventually to get your hair cut with me would be more expensive, so that people who can pay that can pay more. And I went to watch Manchester City a few weeks ago, and I'm not really a football fan, but it was really fun, partly because my brother got his tickets with a free meal and bar and stuff, but they're selling the same thing in a myriad of different ways. So they have the Tunnel Club. Has everyone heard of that? So that's like thousands of pounds to go, and you can, as part of your ticket, the glass tunnel where the players go before they go out onto the pitch, and they've got like it's one way glass, so you can stand sort of sipping champagne with and see the players before they go onto the pitch. And there's a really good podcast about the City Group and what they're planning to do. It's very interesting. But there, it's like a company has bought Manchester City, and they're rolling out this model where they train their own players in sort of Pep style of football, and they're doing it in like they want a team on every continent, so they can train their own players and sort of swap them. There's a team in New York and one in Melbourne and in Australia. But yeah, this idea of selling the same thing and letting people pay more for it who can afford it. Because if I want to make, the best possible shows for our for DKUK, then the money's just got to come from the haircuts. So people have just got to pay for that, and pay for that experience if they can afford it. But yeah, for the rest of it. Oh well, I don't know. Like, would this be a sort of good idea, sort of paid members service? I think there are a few models like of that kind where artists sort of pay for their studios. 5 years is one in London where they pay subs for their studios, and there's a little bit extra, and there's a space, and each artist gets a show in the gallery. But basically, the exhibition making is really hard. It doesn't make sense. People aren't paying to come in. You do like the best show ever, and you get a couple of good reviews, and then that's good. I've been really trying, but it's not like you're going to get a £600 million smash where you can then invest that and give like five artists a chance to really sort of spend a year developing a show, working with a team full time. It's not fair. The Guardian is really struggling to drag itself into this new power world. They now bring in as much money from their member service as they do from advertising. I struggle to read online, but I do listen to their podcasts, so I've started paying like a couple of quid a month. Because I would have spent that on a newspaper every now and again anyway. So yeah, where's art's place in the new power world? I think it's... Oh, I've already said that. Okay. So this is my new shop. I literally got the keys last week. So yeah, we're in the business of providing experiences, and I feel like I'm getting there, but whether people will come and pay or not, I'm not sure yet. That remains to be seen. So I've got the same architect working on the plans. So if you'd have stepped through the door and taken two steps, that's about how big the current space is. Kind of probably up to there. Across. So we've got about 10 times the space. So I'm hugely excited about that. And natural light. We don't currently have any windows. So I've spent 4 years in this arcade with no windows. But yeah, we've got the same architect. He's called Sam Jacob. He was part of Fat Architecture, who did Grayson Perry's The House for Essex. he's one of these architects that I don't really understand. Didn't make that many buildings, but he could have sort of broken into being quite a big architect. But sort of went down the sort of more academic art route. He commutes to Yale over the autumn term to be a professor of architecture over there in America. And I just met him at a wedding. And someone sat us next to each other because he thought we'd get on, and then we did. So, yeah, I'm very lucky to have such an amazing brain sort of thinking about the layout of the space. So we've got a hub. So this is why I was very excited looking at your hub there in action when I came in. So the sort of darker area at the front, that is going to be where that'll be our exhibition space. It's 5 meters wide. So maybe it's a bit wider. How wide is this? Do you know? The top of your head? 3 or 4?
Just under 5. 4.6.
So it's about the same. Yeah, so there'd be enough room to have a sort of sculpture in the middle and some chairs round it facing inwards. We'll have space, and the artist will be able to decide where the chairs go, the configuration of the space. Yeah, so it's about 5 wide and then about 7 deep. So the stepped switcher here. And then this is the display table. I'm a bit dubious about the display table. Tables just get messy in my mind. We've got some sort of shelves in the window for products. The sort of journey of the client when they arrive. So they come in through the door, they'd be greeted by someone who would be there, and then walk through to the back, given a little tour. And we've got this cupboard at the back here which has this polycarb door, and that's where their coats live. And there's a window at the back, so there's sort of natural light flooding in through the window at the back. The configuration of the hub, I think, we might change a little bit, but the idea is that everything that makes the experience of DK UK is on display. Same as what I was saying earlier on about there not being, nothing's hidden, or everything sort of is all part of the same experience. So the office will be there where the exhibition organising is done, the reception desk will be there, and sort of bit of an archive / library table for sort of hot desking, meetings, colour developing, hanging out, reading magazines. And then this area here, this is like the consultation area. And this has got some two-way glass here. So you need to slide across. And it'll be good for the consultation at the beginning, but then also at the end, after your haircut, you're going to sit here, and when you sit down, it will be a window. So you'll kind of look through the window and perhaps see the sort of someone working on an arts council, getting stressed out on an arts council application. and then when you change the light, turn the light on in there, it gets brighter in there, it'll turn into a mirror. So that's our big magic moment. I mean, that's the magic moment in any hairdressing thing, but because we're not doing the haircuts in front of the mirror, we were really thinking of ways to sort of like make that special. That came from another business book which I read called Magic Moments, and that was talking about how we don't remember the whole experience. It's these little sort of like magic moments which are how, that's how our memory works. So they were talking about this hotel which is like the top rated hotel in LA on TripAdvisor, and it just looks like any old hotel. But they've got like these this is the Magic Castle Hotel, that's it, and they've got these little touches. So there's this big brightly coloured phone by the pool, and they're called the Popsicle Hotline, and you can just pick up the phone and say, oh, can I have a popsicle please? And they're like, absolutely. So we'll bring it out to you, what flavour would you like? And someone comes out with a tuxedo on and a silver tray, and they're sort of like, give you your popsicle, and they've just got all these like little details that don't cost anything, but just create that sort of like that magic moment. And so yeah, like, people, it's like really, really recommended. So that's what we're trying to do with that. And yeah, Sam came up with this idea. I thought that was fantastic. So we can, for the big reveal, go in and sort of do the hair and then turn the mirror on it and snap. So yeah, I'm very excited about that. She got her other pictures. So then there's a sink area here at the back. That'll be where we make the tea and mix the hair dye, and then sinks for shampooing along this wall here. So we're going to keep the slat wall in. That's the display system. That works really well. It's part of the original shop that I took over. But when we refitted, we kept the slat wall. It's very photogenic and very practical for art hanging. You know, painting shows is an absolute dream. You just have hooks that you pop in and then slide them around wherever you need them to go. You don't need a spirit level. So we're going to keep the slat wall there. We're really not sure about the floor yet. That's a bit of a nightmare in art hairdressers, because there's still hair dye on it, so we need to figure out how to do that. And yeah, there's a basement as well, so there's enough of space to like hide away actually what you don't want on display. And I think for the first bit we're going to hire out the front half of the basement as like an artist studio as well, see if we can do a bit of an open call and get someone who sort of fits the DK UK mission. So long term plans for this future is this big London shop. I'm actually 1 year ahead on my 5 year plan with that. Potentially have multiple locations around the UK. That's something, I didn't grow up in London. I've been there for a long time now, but I didn't grow up in London. Something that we do really well is, and sort of the core of the mission is making the discussions around art more everyday. I've always felt really lost in the art world, because there was nobody that I could really relate to, like the people that I grew up with there. And so I've always wanted to do shows outside of the art world in a way. And so I thought it'd be really nice if there was a few locations around the UK. You could work with a local curator and commission shows in each location and then tour them around the different salons, and it's a nice way to look at art and spend some time with it. And then that would help to sort of with this sort of London focused thing about like shifting art around and getting artists from outside London shown there, and yeah, that could be really nice. And yeah, we're training up lots of artists to be hairdressers. That's going really well. They sort of take to it. And as much as anything with that, that was about creating an environment that I would like to work. I trained as a hairdresser when I was 17 and then went into art making. And cutting hair is a really nice thing to do. It's got a lot of similarities to sort of what I liked about making art, where you're sort of in the moment and it can be quite mindful process. But hairdressers are quite annoying generally, and hair salons are quite annoying places to be. I worked in some big salons, and there'd perhaps be one or two kind of people I've kept in touch with and made friends, but generally they are quite annoying places. So I really wanted to just make DK UK somewhere that I'd like to work. I think Steve Jobs said when they made the iPhone, they were just trying to, there was nothing that sort of worked with the internet on the phone very well, so they were just trying to make something that worked for them. So yeah, it's sort of really fallen into place as I'm getting more artists involved there. There's just a sort of natural understanding of that, and I can sort of hear the guys like talking about the show, and that would sort of takes the pressure off me from doing the haircut. So it's really hard being that everything when you're cutting someone's hair and then they're really grilling you on the exhibition at the same time. So having sort of apprentices who are really, really good at talking about art. That's really helpful, and they fulfill a very important part of the process and just guide everyone through. I think that's about the end of my talk. I'm happy to keep talking. Is there any questions so far? Yeah. Hi.
That was great, thanks.
Thank you.
I don't know how accurate this is, but I hear on the news that a lot of hairdressing and sort of places like that struggle with business, and a lot of them move into like doing like beauty and grooming and that sort of thing. And I just wondered if you had sort of ambitions to branch out into other sort of avenues.
Other areas of like beauty. Yeah, I'm not against it. Yeah, the mission is to make the discussions around art more commonplace. We've got space now, then I would definitely be open to sort of like nails or other things. Yeah. It would just be that thing of having to making sure that it fitted into the space right. I've set as a mission to become a benefit corporation by 2020, and part of that is sort of really having. Looking after your staff, and so I made the decision of everyone being employed, and we have these meetings where we really talk about stuff, everyone sort of pulling together. And my only fear would be that if it was sort of people coming in doing nails and different stuff, it could sort of confuse things a little bit. 4 years in, people kind of know what we're doing now, so that could be an option. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, this is a bit of a fear. I'm due to open in March 2019. And, like, we all know what's happening in March 2019, despite, like, not listening to the news anymore, you know. But hair salons are struggling. The high street's really struggling.
Where in London is there?
Peckham. Yeah. And so there's quite a lot of people moving to that area. We've been really busy since we opened up the pay what you can offer to have it all day every day. I've just my first artist is qualified now, and we've taken on another hairdresser who's a colourist. So to help build their clientele, I've sort of opened up this offer and we really publicised it. So we've had quite a lot of art students and stuff. There's Goldsmiths and Camberwell, Chelsea.
So after the pay what you can, do they come back again after?
I think we've not really been. We haven't had enough time to check that since we've been pushing it, but I think off the top of my head, I think about 30% tend to rebook an appointment, which is great. We're really happy with that. Mm.
And do the hairdressers that you have come in who aren't artists, how do they adapt or how do they fit in really? It's because you have hairdressers who aren't artists, right?
Yeah, so there was originally, there was one girl who worked with me, Oz, for about 3 years, who started very early on. She'd done a foundation, but she was much more of a hairdresser, and she sort of really sort of grew into it. Mm-hmm. But she's left now, and Helena's here, she's the only one at the moment, and she's, I don't know why she wanted to come and work for us, she's just got sick of, there's obviously something in her that is like, interested in it enough to want to, but I did that, the same thing on her first day, I said to her, I said, oh, you're an artist now, you work here. And she was, great, I've always wanted to be an artist. Great, yeah. And I've had like weekly 1 hour meetings where I've really sort of like got her to ask me as many questions as possible. And you hear her now sort of talking about space and why it's good what we're doing, supporting artists. And she sort of talks about the exhibition. And she's struggling with it. It's a difficult thing. And I wouldn't be against other hairdressers coming in, but they've got to be the right character. I'm not going to take on like a flood of other hairdressers when we open this place. I'm hoping Lowry's going to be the next She's my second apprentice. So she would be the next hairdresser who's ready. And so I'm much more of a focus of sort of training. Yeah, yeah.
Well, those things started to lose their meaning. I mean, words like artist and hairdresser. I mean, you were training artists to be hairdressers. You had an artist who'd been colouring hair. Is it starting to be less significant whether somebody's an artist or a hairdresser? Has art stopped being so much art and become more hairdressing? Hairdressing stopped being so much hairdressing? But do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's all just a thing that happens.
Yeah, and it's the same with whether it's my art practice or not, in a way. Yeah. I think it's a sort of similar question. Is it still my art practice or is it business? And the answer with that is I think yes, it is. But at the end of the day, it's just work. Like, it's work that I enjoy doing, and I get the same from this as I did from making art. And
yeah.
I'm not really that interested in that boundaries. You know, it's just work for me now.
Yeah,
yeah, and I'm really fulfilled in it. And I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
They're workers.
Yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't be against. We had a curator who was working with us last year for a little bit. The current show she's put on, but yeah, thinking about how we commission the shows is another thing. Like, I've got no grand ambitions, and never have done, to be a curator of the shows. I think it'd be much more interesting. I'm spread so thinly across all these different areas, I don't get a chance to see much, to go out to as many exhibitions as I'd like. I think it'd be much more interesting if, like, everyone that works there could sort of chip in to, oh, I've seen the show, I think, you know, we should do this, and we could sit around and discuss that, and then we could invite that person in, perhaps, and then get them to do a presentation on our work, and we could talk about it, and perhaps the whole, it's a bit more like a group working, but of course that takes time. You know, like, I can't expect the workers to do that in their own time. That has to be in work time, and then can the business afford to be paying for that? And I think a hairdressing model, it kind of can't, really. Well, I don't know, I'd like to think it can, but there needs to be money. You know, Google, they get 20% of their time to spend on other projects. But they run at about a 20% profit margin. They earn loads of money. And I don't think hairdressing really works like that. So, yeah, these are definitely sort of thoughts that I've not got an answer for. I've definitely got an idea about how I'd like it to work, but whether that can be or not, I don't know.
Through the talk from the beginning to the end, the beginning and the end of your property, because you talked about it, it's intuitive to you, which is this, and how it works, and how it physically works with you in the space and the art. And then the middle bit, I really recognise, but I have to then work out how it works.
Yeah.
I know how this space works, I know how I connect with people, how dance is what might happen and work for that art side, but then sometimes thinking of the business side and how we survive and all of the complex models. But if you look at this model, then how does that, what does that mean actually? Like, it's only the middle bit, but like much more you were thinking it through with beginning and end. It's just like, you know, and that's just quite nice. That this is where it's done from, is an intuitive decision.
Yeah. I mean, it just so happens that hairdressing and art go really well together. Like, I never even stopped to sort of think this through. Like, it just so happens the two things I've done that are like,
yeah,
snapped together really easily. And I was working as a technician to support my art practice. I wasn't hairdressing at that time, and it was, this started out of desperation, really. I didn't want to go down the academic route. You know, 10 years after college, and you barely have a holiday, and like, you do start to, your priorities change, and you're thinking how you're going to support yourself for the next 10-20 years. What if you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting a holiday or a car or like some new clothes and stuff. And Yeah, so this just started totally out of desperation, really. It just so happened that it went really well together. When I first did it as a pop-up, suddenly there was all these new, it was in an art gallery, and all these people were coming in on the high street and they'd never been in before. Yeah, so I've sort of learned as I've gone along, and especially, like, it was very interesting, like, to have the chance to sort of step back a little bit. And I'm still, the audiobooks have been very helpful for me. That's a way to sort of get through some books a little bit. And it does all feed in there, and it was really nice to sort of think back to the questions that were in the middle, and have an opportunity to reflect. But like I said, I'm not academic. I'm like stretched really thin, negotiating commercial leases and payroll, you know, while doing all this stuff as well. It's like, but that's the reality of it. And I think the more we start talking about the realities of being an artist and how we're supposed to survive, like, hopefully, I'm really hopeful with this sort of, like, the younger generation coming through, like, who've I guess they've grown up post 2008, which was the financial thing and the iPhone thing. So to have, like, authority constantly be questioned, and also have this information, access to information really quickly, I sort of see they're a lot more sort of politically savvy than my generation that grew up with, like, TFI Friday and just, like, boozing. Yeah, I don't know, another big generalisation, but yeah, I'm hopeful for sort of, like, the art for the new power world. I don't know what that looks like yet, but as long as people are starting discussions, you know, the white fuga, like, really interesting, and thinking about how it can work.
I'm just a little sort of trying to get my head around the idea that what kind of customers you get coming through the door, because they're paying for it. So I understand that you do the pay what you can at the beginning.
Yeah.
But then they're paying for a service. So do you think that kind of makes it okay that they have to pay to see art because they're paying for another service? Or are you worried that there's only a certain type of person that's going to be coming in, and there's going to be another type of person that's excluded? Especially because it's kind of in Peckham, and so many artists and young people moving to Peckham, and how is that affecting sort of the communities that already exist there?
Yeah. Is that two questions?
So I'm not sure how to. I mean, I guess it might be a question about gentrification, and also a question about is the fact that they're paying for a service.
Yeah.
That is getting ahead, and okay, then that they have to pay to see art.
I suppose they're paying for the experience.
Mm.
And that's sort of like only very recently what I've realised, that that's what we do as a business and as a company. We're providing an experience. Mm. And that is the haircut and the exhibition. So it's both of those things. So to pay what you can, I mean, so I trained with Tony and Guy, so our appointments are an hour long.
Mm.
And I suppose in a hairdressing salon, that's what you're actually selling time. So that is a particular way of cutting someone's hair. So it's not like in a barber shop, you might pay £6, £15, and it takes 10 minutes. It kind of equates to the same price as 40. You know, £40 for an hour, £50 for an hour. A barber's haircut might last 2 weeks if you want to keep it fresh, but one of our haircuts would last for 2 months.
Mm.
So it's kind of the same in a way. It's around about the same kind of money that's spent. So the pay what you can offer was a way to get people in who aren't used to that kind of haircut. But I can't get away from the fact that that kind of haircut costs money to provide. You know, I am a business. I'm not a charity. So I think the sort of pay what you can is like a very generous offer.
Yeah.
because I wanted everyone to have the chance to come in and experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the second part of the question? Do you want to talk about gentrification more?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I should ask.
Yeah, so I suppose I moved to Peckham 14 years ago. And so it has changed quite a bit. It's more changed much quicker in the last few years, in a way. When I opened the salon 4 years ago, there's always an entrepreneurial spirit there. There's a lot of sort of Asian shops, if anyone's not been, where they've got the sort of phone card shops in the grocery shop, and you know, there's lots of these layers of like stuff. But the businesses, when I opened DK UK, I mean, gentrification means displacement, doesn't it? That's the definition. So it's like moving, trying to do something to move people out, displacing people. And all the businesses that were opening 4 years ago absolutely loved the area. You know, there was Yam Records and Alibaba's Juice Bar. There was no want of wanting to change or displace anyone. You know, and the arcade is very nice. It's like it actually matches the ethnic breakdown from the census of Nunhead and Peckham perfectly. Sort of 40% black, 40% white, and 20% Asian. So that was really nice sort of community there. And the back half of the arcade was empty when we opened. Everyone's been very supportive and really enjoyed it. There are some shops opening now. There's like a bakery across the road which doesn't take cash, which like really riles me. I mean, that says a lot about who you want in your business, and I find that offensive. That I often go in and try and pay with cash. I've done it about 3 or 4 times just to have the conversation again. Like, yeah, I find it really annoying. So there is a few businesses now, sort of, who aren't thinking in the same way. Yeah.
So your customers are quite diverse.
No, not that diverse. No. I mean, we can do afro hair. We have about 2 clients that come in.
Mm.
Yeah. The reason of taking on a curator was to get more diversity in the art program. Because, as I said, one person can, you know, I'm just grabbing, oh, that'll be good. I haven't got the time to think about it. So I really wanted to sort of get someone who had the time to sort of think about that. I think it's a, if you're running an art gallery, you know, if you're not programming a diverse program, you're part of the problem, you know. Yeah, so I do recognise that as a responsibility. But I trained as well. I trained in the way that I cut hair, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I can't cut afro hair. I've got someone who can, but yeah. I'd definitely like to push it more. Yeah. Was there another bit to your question as well?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. 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 Like I said, we get a lot of the art students in, and that's the sort of struggle at Tony and Guy, for example. When I worked there, they like all their ad campaigns, these like edgy, cool haircuts, but their whole clientele is kind of like middle-aged women, because they're the ones that can afford it. You know, so it's nice that we do the pay what you can, because from a hairdressing perspective, you get to do all the much more fun haircuts. But yeah, ultimately, I mean, if you were to start to pay for, if you start to charge them to come in here, you know, who's going to be coming in? Probably going to be getting less people coming in, but how else are we going to, like, how else can we put on these shows and raise the money from the art without going down the commercial route? And the whole point of doing the haircuts is because we don't want to go down the commercial route. Just doing the commercial route is hard enough. You know, that's kind of not working for so many galleries at the moment. So you can't sort of do the hairdressing business and the gallery and a commercial gallery at the same time. That's just too much. So focus on the hair business to try and make that, put that, get that, putting some money in to support the exhibition. Yeah, like I said, I haven't got any answers, but like it's good to start asking questions. Yeah. It just really pisses me off that like the artists have to be the ones subsidising it. There's a hire space in the arcade, and it's amazing. People come and pay to hire it out, and they've made their work, and then they sit there for like all weekend, and like, there might be like five people come, and they come and chat to them when they come in, and like it's just an amazing thing to see. Like it's so innate in people that they want to make this stuff and show it. But yeah, I just can't think of how we give people universal basic income is a really good idea. You know, that would be a way to start, sort of like free people's time a little bit. So like I said, I don't know anything about economics, but it seems like this the people that came up as Adam Smith, isn't it, who is it classical? Someone help me out. Anyway, these people who came up with the way that the economies run and the way economics is taught were doing this like 150 years ago, you know, in a completely different world, where they probably had like a maid and a wife supporting these men so they could sit in their homes and like come up with these sort of like abstract theories, and we're still sort of living by them now, and like the world's changed so much. And like it's, I guess in 2008 we were so fucked that people just had to put the pieces back together before things collapsed, and then it's now 10 years later, people are kind of like, okay, well, trying to rethink things a little bit, and I find that most hopeful in a way. Like, I don't know if I could make art now. There's so much going on in the world that, like, the world's just a mad place. Like, to find the headspace to concentrate on these the details that you need to spend making art. Yeah, I really admire it.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah. We'll be far away today.
Thank you very much.